to open your word and to see what it is that you've taught us in there, what you've revealed about yourself and about us and about this creation in which we live in. Father, I pray that you would open our eyes to see and our ears to hear, that you would protect us from my words and help yours to shine through. In Christ's name, amen. Alrighty, so it's been a long week for me, and so I'm just kind of curious, what do y'all remember about what we talked about last week? There's a fair bit of, we covered a fair bit of ground. Broad terms is fine. Okay, yeah, so we talked about the beginning of the divided monarchy. And so we talked a little bit about kind of the end of Solomon and how Solomon, while he started really well, he didn't end well. And because of that, then God tells Rehoboam, or tells Solomon, he tells Jeroboam, I don't remember if he ever tells Rehoboam, actually, that the kingdom's going to be ripped away from Rehoboam, all except for one tribe. And so that's basically what we see happening, right? Is then God fulfills what he's already told them. So, if we open up to 1 Kings 11, we're going to pick up in a similar place and go a slightly different direction with it. So last time we kind of focused on Solomon in when we read through this section. Now we're going to read 1 Kings 11, verse 26 to 40, and we're going to look at Jeroboam and the northern kingdom. Would somebody like to read 1 Kings 11, verses 26 to 40? Meredith, thank you. Ephraimite. Mm-hmm. Egypt. Shishak. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So last time we looked at this passage and we said that here we see God promising for the second time. This is 1 Kings 11, verses 26 to 40. And we said that God is promising for the second time that he's going to tear the kingdom away from Solomon's son because of Solomon's idolatry. But the other thing that we see here is not only is it a promise that he's going to tear the kingdom away from Rehoboam, Solomon's son, Solomon's heir, but he's also going to give a kingdom to Jeroboam. But that kingdom is granted conditionally. So if you look, for example, at verse 38, in the ESV it says, "And if you will listen to all that I command you, and will walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, I will be with you and will build you a sure house as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you." So again, we have this kingdom now that's being given to Jeroboam under the condition of obedience. And so there are two types of covenants. We kind of talked a little bit about this, I don't know, several months ago. Where on the one hand we get covenants that are unconditional, and on the other hand we find covenants that are conditional. So when Moses goes up on Sinai and God gives him the law, the covenant is conditional. God grants them the land under the condition that they're willing to live according to his law. On the other hand, we see God's promise to Abraham, where you get the big ceremonial service where the animals are split in two and Abraham goes to sleep and sees God as a cloud of fire go through the split animals by himself. And the picture there, at least, is of God himself is taking on this covenant unilaterally. There's nothing higher than God, and God himself will bear this covenant. There's nothing that Abraham can do to break this. And so we see both types here in the Old Testament. With the kingdom of Israel, though, what we see is the conditional type. Which makes sense. That was the original condition of the United Monarchy, right? And so in Deuteronomy, we see that if you're willing to live according to the promises of God, according to the commands of God, then you'll live long in the land and prosper. So if you look at Deuteronomy 6, for example, that's why the people are told that they're to teach their children all of these statutes. That's why they're told that these are so important. Deuteronomy 6. "Now this is the commandment, the statutes, and the rules that the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, that you may do them in the land in which you are going to possess, that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son and your son's son, by keeping all of his statutes and his commandments, which I command you all the days of your life, that your days may be long." "Hear therefore, O Israel, and be careful to do them, that it may go well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey." And so again, we get this promise of the land that goes all the way back to Abraham, and yet, the promise for this land, at least, is conditional. Very much so, we see something similar with Jeroboam. And yet, while we have no recorded response from Jeroboam, so it's not like God says this and then Jeroboam says, "Sure, we'll do that," and therefore it's done, right? Not at all. The Bible looks to his actions. God gives him a command, much like God gave Solomon the command. And it's not about what's said, it's about the way that it's lived out. And so we see before I go there, if we look in verse 40, one of the things that we should see, at least, is that Solomon sought, therefore, to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam arose and fled to Egypt. So whatever's going on here, Jeroboam 1 is not listening to God already. Because God tells him, I'm not tearing the kingdom out of Solomon's hands. And yet clearly Jeroboam is doing something, laying some kind of groundwork, doing something where Solomon is aware that he's there. He's aware of him as a claimant to the throne. And so because of that, Solomon chases him out of the kingdom. And then eventually we see, after Solomon dies, that in chapter 12, verses 1 to 15, we get this story of how he goes and he stirs up the rabble of the people of the kingdom. He goes and stirs up those forced laborers that he was over. And he tells them, you know, let me just read it. It'll be easier. In verse 4, chapter 12, verse 4, we see, your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. And he told them to go away and let me seek counsel, basically. And then they come back, and he's sought counsel, and we get the choice that he made, and we talked a good bit about that last week. And basically what he says is, my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. The picture is that you're complaining because you think your load is heavy now. Just wait. And so we're waiting to see, well, and from that point, as we saw last week, the kingdom splits. But because Rehoboam is unwilling to yield, he's unwilling to fulfill the role of a good king, which is to serve the people. And because of that, the kingdom splits. And so now we do have these two kingdoms, as God has told us we would have. We have the northern kingdom, Israel, and the southern kingdom, Judah. The northern kingdom consists of 10 tribes. The southern kingdom of, we'll say one for now, it's really two. So, we're waiting to see then, what does Jeroboam do? It's one of the questions that should be kind of prodding us as we're reading through this is, will Jeroboam actually live up to the covenant? And certainly there's, I guess we should say that David was seen to have lived up to the covenant. So at the very least, it's not necessarily as rigid of a restriction, I guess, as rigid of a fulfillment as we might would interpret it when we're talking about salvation today. And so what we see very, very quickly, if you look at First Kings 12, starting about verse 25, we see, then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. And he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David if this people go up and offer sacrifice in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem. Then the heart of this people will turn again to their Lord, to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, the king of Judah. So the king took counsel and made two calves of gold. And he said to the people, you have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And he set one in Bethel and one in Dan. Then this thing became a sin, for the people went as far as Dan to be before one. He also made temples on high places and appointed priests from among all the people who were not of the Levites. And Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and he offered sacrifices on the altar, so he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves he made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places that he made. He went up to the altar that he had made in Bethel on the 15th day in the 8th month, in the month that he had devised from his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the people of Israel and went up to the altar to make offerings. And so we see very, very quickly that Jeroboam is not interested in fulfilling God's commandment. He's looking for some human path. And so while God has told him that I will assure your kingdom, the main thing that he's concerned about is, well, if I let the people continue to go back to Jerusalem and worship God the way that God has commanded that they worship him, and we looked at the law of centralization last week, if you remember that, then they're going to turn from me. So one, he's not listening to God again. The other big thing that we should be noticing here is that the constant temptation of all of these people, how is it that they fall? Every one of them turns off into idolatry. Whether it's Solomon and his wives leading him astray into idolatry where he goes after the foreign gods, or it's, thankfully I have a bookmark, but whether it's Solomon and the foreign gods, or it's Jeroboam and building the high places and the calves, which, does that incident remind you of anything else? And so it's kind of striking because it's actually the same words even. So Aaron the priest, when the calf comes out of the fire, says, "Behold, the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt." Sure. I think a lot of it is just in Egypt. Cows were worshipped in much the same way that they are in India today, where they're just this massive animal that's bigger than anything else that they've seen that lives. But it was fairly it was a fairly common image in the ancient Near East for whatever reason. So he rebels against God into idolatry. And he does it in several ways. So let's take a moment here and just ask, what does he do where he goes wrong? Like, what in that sequence does he go wrong in? I'm thinking more the 12, 15 to 25, 24. Or no, I'm sorry. It's 15, 25 to 33. Yeah. My bad. Jumping around just a little bit here. Yeah, he fell into idolatry himself first. Pastor Jim. Yeah, absolutely. So he kind of puts himself up there as an idol. Yep, absolutely. I see another hand somewhere in here. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yep, absolutely. And so how does that play out in terms of like the physical means that we see? Certainly that's the deeper sin piece of it. But in what specific ways does he go and break God's law? There's at least two or three here. Making an image, yep. Yep, absolutely. Which in some ways kind of breaks two, right? So on the one hand, it's worshiping God in the way that the gods of the ancient Near East were worshipped. And second of all, it's disregarding that God has just chosen his temple. Yes. It was happening. That was Molech predominantly. Absolutely. And so we see that it's not just some little thing. It's massive. And it sweeps across the entirety of Israelite life. So beginning at 13 now, we see that then God sends a prophet to warn Jeroboam. And we're going to spend a little bit of time on this, in part just to kind of introduce prophets a little bit better, and two, because it kind of shows the spiral that we're about to start seeing, much like some of those instances in the book of Judges show the same thing. So it starts out, "And behold, a man of God came out of Judah by the word of the Lord to Bethel. Jeroboam was standing by the altar to make offerings, and the man cried against the altar by the word of the Lord, saying, 'O altar, altar, thus says the Lord, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and he shall sacrifice on you the priests of the high places who make offerings on you, and human bones shall be burned on you.' And he gave a sign the same day, saying, 'This is the sign of the sign that the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be torn down, and the ashes that are on it shall be poured out.' And when the king heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried against the altar at Bethel, Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, 'Seize him!' And his hand, which he stretched out against him, dried up so that he could not draw it back to himself. The altar was torn down, and the ashes poured out from the altar, according to the sign that the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. And the king said to the man of God, 'Entreat now the favor of the Lord your God, and pray for me, that my hand may be restored to me.' And the man of God entreated the Lord, and the king's hand was restored to him, and became as it was before. And the king said to the man of God, 'Come home with me, and refresh yourself, and I will give you a reward.' And the man of God said to the king, 'If you gave me half your house, I will not go in with you, and will not eat bread or drink water in this place. For so it was commanded me by the word of the Lord, saying, You shall neither eat bread nor drink water, nor return by the way that you came.' So he went another way, and did not return by the way that he came to Bethel." So, let's start out, I guess, by asking the basic question, what is a prophet? Kim? Sure. It's someone who carries a message from God. In the context of the Old Testament, frequently it's a special message. It's a new revelation. And yet so frequently it also builds on past revelation. And so the role of the prophet both foretells, tells things that people don't necessarily want to hear and yet are already known, and also foretells. So it tells the future. So you get both of those roles. So let's look at Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 to 22. Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 to 22. So we see, "The Lord your God will raise up from you, or for you, a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen. Just as you desired of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly, when you said, 'Let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, or see this great fire any more, lest I die.' And the Lord said to me, 'They are right in what they have spoken. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. And I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And whoever will not listen to my words that I shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. But the prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name that I have not commanded him to speak, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that same prophet shall die. And if you say in your heart, 'How may we know the word that the Lord has not spoken?' when a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the word does not come to pass or come true, that is a word that the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You need not be afraid of him." And so even as far back as Deuteronomy, we're told that there are true prophets and there are false prophets. And there's a need to discern between the two. And so one of the things that we see that's to help us then to discern between the two are the signs that God gives. And so the prophet frequently is talking about things that won't happen for a long time. So you can't just look to see, well, is the kingdom really going to fall in 70 years? Kim? Where is the origin of the false prophet? That's a great question. The short answer is that, I guess, the answer that I will give is that if you look in, like, 1 John in particular, also in 1 Timothy, you get a lot of connection between the false prophet, the false teacher, and the Antichrist. And so all of those are tied together where they're sent from the same source. They're sent from this rebellion and this sin, and they manifest themselves by teaching things that are not true. Frequently they come in the name of the Lord. And they're trying to deceive, if possible, even the very elect of God. And yet they're speaking things that they have not heard. Yes, we do. Absolutely. So we have to then look. Well, so the prophet brings frequently a word from the Lord that is a word of judgment. It's a word or a word of blessing. We see that in all of the major prophets in particular, where there is some far-off blessing yet to come, and yet how can we be sure that this message is true? And so then there is frequently these supernatural signs that happen in the moment. And so in this case, the prophet tells Jeroboam that you will know that this is the word of the Lord because that altar on which you're about to do this heinous thing in the sight of God will split and the ashes and bones will be thrown everywhere. And it happens. Jeroboam stretches out his hand and his hand dries up to the point where he can't pull it back anymore. Because God protects his prophet. It's, again, something we see a lot as we run through particularly Kings, where here in a little bit we'll get, I don't know if we'll actually talk about Elijah or not, but there's one scene where he's on top of a mountain and they send the 50 and the commander of the 50 to go get Elijah, and Elijah calls down fire from heaven and consumes the 50 two or three times. Until finally, one commander of the 50 comes and guarantees his safe passage. And so we get this message, one, that the prophet is not to protect himself because God will do it. So the prophet frequently is walking into a dangerous situation with a powerful person and speaking to them words that they don't want to hear. Well, so in this case, he walks back, or he begins to walk back to Judah. We'll elaborate a little bit further on that here in a minute. Just goes on about his way. You have others who aren't quite so fortunate, and some of them are more or less killed on the spot. Jeremiah is the prophet. I can't remember the king right now. But yeah, and so there's this idea that while there is blessing prophesied, when you read through like Isaiah, for example, there's a whole lot of woe before you ever get the blessing. You read through Ezekiel, there's a whole lot of condemnation before you ever get the blessing. And basically the condemnation goes to, finally, there's nothing left. And then God rebuilds from a remnant. But seemingly not their remnant. God commands the prophet. God gives the prophet a word to speak. The prophet walks into the situation under God's protection to deliver this message. And for this message to be seen and known. And yet people don't follow it. So, in this instance, we know that Jeroboam has been given a promise of God, that God will establish his kingdom. God will establish his kingdom, provided that he's willing to follow the commands of God. And then he rebels against God. And so God sends a prophet to warn him. And not only does the prophet warn him, the prophet brings miraculous signs by which he can know that this message truly is from God. And yet nothing happens. And so as we read on just a little bit, I'm going to pick up in... I'll just summarize the next bit. But it's the rest of the chapter. What happens is that there's another old prophet in Bethel. And this other old prophet has not received a word from the Lord. But he goes and he tells the prophet from Judah, we'll start calling him the southern prophet now. He goes and tells the southern prophet that, God has told me that you should come aside and eat bread and drink water with me. And so he takes the prophet back to his house because he knows that God has commanded this prophet not to do that. When the prophet does acquiesce to this older prophet, what we see happens is the older prophet does get a word from the Lord. And it's a word of judgment on the younger prophet because he disobeyed the word of the Lord. So the southern prophet then is found later dead on the side of the road, and his body is basically being left alone by the wild animals, ironically enough, so that they can discern who it is, essentially. Is it Jeroboam? I thought it was the older prophet. Yeah, the older prophet goes back and buries him in his grave. Yep. And it's ironic, too, because then the older prophet basically says, when I die, put my bones there with his. Yep. Yep. And yet, in one sense, at least, they're both false prophets. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, you've had the word from the Lord. How can you turn aside? yeah, absolutely. And so that's what we see. And so I think this is kind of indicative of what happens in the divided kingdom, the divided monarchy. But because what you see now is the man of God isn't even willing to follow God and to trust on God and to believe in God's promises, whether that's for blessing or for judgment. And so increasingly we see the spiral that comes out of that where things do get worse and worse and worse until finally they're sent off into exile. And yet, at the end of the day, the heart of it all starts right here. And the heart of it all doesn't really get that much worse. It's just the outworkings of it start to accumulate. And so in verses 33 and 34, we see that after this thing, Jeroboam did not turn from his evil way, but made priests for the high places again from among all the people. Any who would, he ordained to be priests of the high places. And this thing became sin to the house of Jeroboam, so as to cut it off and to destroy it from the face of the earth. And so again, we see Jeroboam's not interested in the commands of God. He's not interested in the people that God has set up to mediate between him and the people. He's not interested in the places that God has set up as the mediation between God and his people. He's not interested in the times. And so none of these things are of interest to Jeroboam. And so he rebels against God in all of them. And I guess the point I'm going to close on here is that things aren't any better in the Southern Kingdom. I'll probably regret doing this with this short of a time, but we're going to try it. So in 1 Kings 14, verses 21 to 30, we see, "Now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. His mother's name was Naamah, the Ammonite, and Judah did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins that they had committed, more than all that their fathers had done. For they also built for themselves high places and pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there were also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations that the Lord drove out before the people of Israel." That right there probably is enough. And so we see that things are no better in the Southern Kingdom. When we read, particularly again, Kings, we get these summaries of the kings that start out at the beginning. So they'll introduce a new king and they'll say, so-and-so was king and he began reigning when he was this old and he reigned for so many years and he was a good king or he was a bad king. And then he did these things that made him a good king or a bad king. And so you can kind of then get a feel for how is it that all steps through. So in this case, we see that Rehoboam was a bad king. And he was a bad king because he led the people into idolatry. And this is the part that I'm probably going to regret going into. But so one of the major, I guess, metaphors for the covenant of God and his people, but also for, or by connection, the covenant breaking is that of spiritual idolatry, or spiritual adultery, rather. And so we see that all over the prophets, whether it's Ezekiel 23, Ezekiel 16, Jeremiah 3, Ezekiel 6, Hosea, the whole book. We get this idea, one, that God is married to his people. And so like in the New Testament, we see that the church is the bride of Christ. In the Old Testament, we see that God's bride is Israel. And those two kind of are synonymous in some sense. And yet, when Israel rebels, what Israel is doing is they're breaking the covenant. And so, as marriage is a covenant, and infidelity outside of that is breaking that covenant, so infidelity with the covenant with God is then portrayed as spiritual adultery. And so, when we're told in Ezekiel 23:11, I'm just going to read the one verse. If y'all want to read that outside of here, that would probably be good. We are told so there are two sisters in this little, I don't know what you want to call it, a parable, story, something. And they're identified for us. So the older sister is Ohola, and she's Samaria, the northern kingdom, Israel. And Oholibah, who is Jerusalem, she's the southern kingdom. And by the time we get to verse 11, we see that her sister, so we're told all about what the northern kingdom has done and how she's gone off. And then we're told that her sister Oholibah saw this, and she became more corrupt than her sister in her lust and in her whoring, which was worse than that of her sister. And so again, we're told that in some sense, I guess first off, that things can be worse. That there's actually a scale of some sort. We're told that, well, actually, let's just go into this for a minute. Judah is unique from Israel, right? In that, in Judah, we have the temple. We have the priesthood. And it's all central. It's right there in Jerusalem. It's the place where God has commanded that his people are to meet with the priests, to be mediated with God. It's the place where the worship of God is to happen. And yet we're told that the people of the southern kingdom built high places and Asherim. So even though they don't have the excuse, even though it's not excused, of the northern kingdom, saying that, well, I'm not sending my people to the other kingdom to worship God the way he's declared. They don't have to go anywhere. God's place is right there in their midst. And yet still they turn astray. So with that, I'm gonna close in prayer, Pastor Jim. Yeah. Absolutely. And so again, you get that special mediation, or it's that special mediating presence of God where he makes himself known in some special way, and it makes us all the more condemned. You know, living on this side and seeing what God has already done even puts us in a place where we're more condemned, because we've seen what God has done through his Son and still rejected him. I kind of want to end on a little bit of a down note, but we'll pick up with some lighter stuff here next, or week after next, I think. But let's pray. Father, again, I thank you for your word.